This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.
Regular listeners of Lake Effect will likely remember local leader Reggie Jackson. He is the head griot of America's Black Holocaust Museum and can be regularly seen in the community giving presentations on the history of segregation in Milwaukee.
Jackson was featured in this month's Milwaukee Magazine in an article that looked at his work in the community and with America's Black Holocaust Museum, currently a virtual museum which shuttered its physical space in 2008. The museum recently broke ground on a new space in Milwaukee's Bronzeville neighborhood.
Jackson joined me in studio to talk about his work. Reggie, thank you so much for joining us once again here on Lake Effect.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Great to be back again, Joy. I appreciate it.
So we've had you in a few times, and last time we spoke, it was about the history of segregation in Milwaukee. But, you know, something we really didn't touch on is really how you got into this work. What brought you to where you are now?
Well, it goes back to my early years as a child. I was always very inquisitive. I was kind of a nerdy kid, always reading. I loved encyclopedias. Those were my favorite books. And so I had this very inquisitive nature. And one of the things I loved a lot was history. And so I was always looking for an outlet for all of this information I had in my brain. And in 2002, I went to America's Black Holocaust Museum as a volunteer, and they needed griots to give tours at the museum. So I went through the griot training program and became a griot. And within about a year, I became the head griot, and I conducted the training for the other griots at the museum. So that was kind of how I started doing this type of work. In terms of talking about the segregation, a little over a year and a half ago, I was contacted by a reporter from CNN who was doing an article about segregation. And people always call or come to Milwaukee when they're working on segregation. And so he came to Milwaukee, and my colleague and I gave him a tour, and we told him about the history of segregation in Milwaukee and kind of showed him around to see what it looks like. And he wrote a really nice article on CNN's website. And after that, people were calling me, asking me about segregation. So I realized that I had to dig into it a little deeper and learn more about it. So I started to do research for public presentations about the history of segregation in Milwaukee and learning how Milwaukee became the most segregated metropolitan area. And it's been just an eye-opening experience for me. There were a lot of things that I thought were true that weren't really true, a lot of things that I knew about but didn't know about them in depth. And when I dug into them, I was really, really surprised by some of them. And so I've been doing these public presentations now since, I think, March. I did the first one that I call Hidden Impact of Segregation. And I've done them around the city and even outside the city. And I'll be doing it again next week at a church in town here in Milwaukee. So I think I've done it altogether maybe 12 times. And the response has been really, really just overwhelming to me. We've had overflow crowds at several of those venues. And I think people are really very interested in this history. And so I've just been fascinated by the journey that I've been on, learning about the history of how Milwaukee became the most segregated place.
Now, in digging into some of the history of segregation in Milwaukee, you're really digging into some of your own history, some of what you experienced. Is there anything from that time period, as you've been researching this, that has really surprised you, that has really stuck out as something that you lived through that you didn't quite understand at the time?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that I used to do, my friends and I, we were, you know, athletes. We loved playing sports. We played basketball. We played football, baseball. But we used to go and play football, and we would always look for, like, places that were wide open spaces to play football at. So we used to go down on Fond du Lac Avenue around 17th Street, that area, because there were wide open spaces to play football. And so I didn't know at the time why there were these wide open spaces, these empty blocks. I had no idea why the blocks were empty. And I discovered as I was doing the research for this project that in the late 60s, there was a plan to build a freeway that would have been known as the Park West Freeway. It would have been an extension of the Park East Freeway that was downtown. And it was going to extend up Fond du Lac Avenue to North Avenue and then turn west. And between North Avenue and Meineke, it would travel all the way to Sherman Boulevard and then meet up with another freeway. Well, because of community protests, they decided not to build a freeway. But before they made the decision to not build a freeway, they had already gotten all of those homes and torn down 1,500 homes to build that freeway. So all of those empty spaces that we played in used to be residences. And I had no idea that that was the case until I did the research. And the sad thing about it is a lot of those spaces to this day are still, you know, just empty blocks that people drive past and they have no idea why the blocks are empty. And the area between North Avenue and Minor Key that was all residential was rezoned by the city to commercial. And so now there's between, say, 21st Street and Sherman, I actually drove just to see. There are a total of about 10 residences that are single-family homes where there used to be hundreds. And so that was one of the probably the most surprising thing that I found during the research that I actually, you know, experienced part of and was completely clueless as to why it was that way.
Now, America's Black Holocaust Museum, for people who might not know anything about the museum, especially since it hasn't had really a storefront since 08, what is it? What is the museum?
So the museum was founded by James Cameron, and at the age of 16, he lived in Marion, Indiana, and he was the victim of a lynching. It was a hot August day, August 7th, 1930. He was taken out of the jail, had a rope around his neck. They were about to lynch him as well, and he ended up surviving miraculously. And he tells the story of how he survived and what precipitated the lynching in his memoirs that he wrote, A Time of Terror, which the museum has published under our publishing arm. So he survived the lynching. His two friends, Abram Smith and Thomas Shipp, were both killed on that day. And it's the most famous lynching photograph of all. It was actually when the lynching happened, that photo was spread around the world. People everywhere saw it. And it became the focus of anti-lynching work around the country. In fact, the song Strange Fruit that Billie Holiday made famous. She actually didn't write the song. It was a young Jewish man who saw the photograph, and he wrote the song as a result of that photograph. So Dr. Cameron survived the lynching. He ended up spending 4 years incarcerated in the adult prison in Indiana, and he got out, and he moved to Michigan for a short period of time, but he eventually came back. He came back to Marion, and he actually interviewed people who were members of the lynch mob to ask them, you know, what did they remember seeing that day. And he became very actively engaged in civil rights in Indiana. At that particular time, the 1920s, 1930s, Indiana had more Klan members than any other state. They were a hotbed of the Klan. So he was really risking his life doing civil rights work there. He was able to open up several chapters of the NAACP in the state of Indiana. And in 1952, he decided to finally leave Indiana because of death threats that he and his family received. He and his wife were raising their children. They became very frustrated. They were actually planning to leave the country and move to Canada. So on their way to Canada, they drove back to his home state, Wisconsin. He was born in La Crosse. And they stopped in Milwaukee. He found a job in Milwaukee and made it their home for the rest of their lives. So at the age of 74, he started the museum. And the result of a trip that he and his wife took in 1979, they went on a holy pilgrimage to Jerusalem. And when they were in Jerusalem, they visited Yad Vashem, the Jewish Holocaust memorial there. And he tells how he and his wife were both very emotional leaving Yad Vashem. And there's a garden outside of Yad Vashem, which is dedicated to those people who assisted the Jewish families to escape the Nazis. And so they were standing in this garden, and he turned to his wife, Virginia. He said, Virginia, we need a museum like this in America to tell what happened to blacks and the freedom-loving whites who've helped blacks along the way. And so that was the genesis of the beginnings of the museum and why he gave it the name that he gave it. And it took him a little while, and in 1988, he opened the museum formally. In 1994, he moved into its permanent home on 4th and North Avenue, and the museum stayed open for 20 years. And the museum is a museum dedicated to a hidden part of our history, a part of our history that's kind of ugly and hard to talk about, that we don't really learn anything about in school. And so Dr. Cameron's mission was very simple, to dig up this history and make it available for people who came to the museum and have conversations about it and have conversations about the impact of that particular history, and then work on using that information to develop a process of healing from that trauma of that's divided the nation from that particular history. And so his goal was really to create what he used to always refer to as an America that stood up to the ideals of the founding fathers, that lived as one single and sacred nationality. So it's a museum that's designed to lead us to reconciliation and healing, in addition to educating us about that history as well.
I'm speaking right now with Reggie Jackson. He's the head griot of America's Black Holocaust Museum. And when you say the word Holocaust, I think people have a very specific idea of what that is, specifically 1940s Germany and the intended extermination of the Jewish people. Mm-hmm. What do you think is comparable between the Jewish Holocaust, which many people think of, and what's happened in American history?
You know, there's been a lot of people that have contacted us about the name, and people have issues with the name of the museum. And I would always tell them the story, the genesis of the name. And in fact, those horrific events that happened to the Jewish people throughout Europe in the 1930s and 1940s at the hands of the Nazi Party were actually not formally known as a Holocaust, even by the Jewish people, for many years after it happened. It didn't become used prominently to describe that particular history on a regular basis until like the late 50s, early 60s. They began to call it something completely different at first and eventually the Holocaust, which is an old Greek word, which is a word used to describe, complete destruction, typically by fire. One of the things the Greeks were famous for is when they conquered other nations, they would literally burn their villages to the ground and force those people to follow them and join their nation and their army. And so that's kind of the etymology of the word. But the museum, is dedicated to what we call the Black Holocaust in America. And so that encompasses the history of the first Africans to arrive in 1619 in Jamestown, Virginia on a slaving ship. And it goes through the entire history of the enslavement of Africans in this country. We talked in great detail about the journey over in the Middle Passage, the journey on those slaving ships that brought these Africans to America. And then we look at what happened after, the Civil War ended, the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, which ended slavery, and then the 14th and 15th Amendments, which gave Black citizenship rights and then gave Black men the right to vote. So we talk about that period of time and the transition that took place. You know, there was this period from 1865 till 1877 that's known as Reconstruction, when Blacks were, living with freedom for the first time as mandated by the law. And there were people who resisted that level of freedom that they had. And when there was a disputed presidential election in 1876, the election turned on a decision to make a compromise. And part of that compromise was to take the last of the federal troops out of the South who were protecting Blacks and the rights that they had been given. So immediately they began to lose those privileges and rights of citizenship that they had gained. And groups like the Ku Klux Klan, the White Camellia, groups like that became terrorist organizations to terrorize Blacks repeatedly and make sure that they didn't live a normal life. And then you began to see a turn in terms of how the country looked at them and laws that began to develop to disenfranchise those Blacks who had been voting. But you also began to see this massive amount of lynchings that would take place from the 1880s all the way through the 1920s and even up to 1930. There was a massive number of lynchings, nearly a lynching a day in some years. And you went from a period of time where lynching is kind of an old institution in America. We were lynching people during Revolutionary War days. you know, for being cattle rustlers and things of that nature. But they typically didn't kill people when they lynched them. They would tar and feather people, beat people publicly, things of that nature. They began to kill people. And then this lynching that occurred in a massive scale beginning in the 1880s was primarily done specifically to make sure that blacks didn't have a sense of themselves that was a positive sense of themselves. And so the degradation that came with lynching, you know, it wasn't just the fact that they killed people, they humiliated them, they tortured people, they cut off body parts as souvenirs. There were mass lynchings attended by tens of thousands of people. They were advertised in the newspaper ahead of time. People would jump on freight trains and travel to these mass lynchings. And so that became a norm in the country for about 40 years. So we talk about that, obviously. And that period is known in history as the nadir, the lowest point in American history for blacks by some historians. And, of course, after lynchings kind of lost favor, we talk about the things that were left over in terms of some of those laws that were written that degraded black people, such as the Jim Crow laws, black codes that were written to segregate blacks. In 1896, the Supreme Court in Plessy v. Ferguson ruled that separate facilities are perfectly okay. So they began to live with this Jim Crow segregation. And, you know, we've seen signs, the Jim Crow signs, you know, black and white, you know, water fountains, colored water fountain, white water fountain, movie theaters, all those different things. But this Jim Crow segregation was a nationwide thing. It wasn't just in the South. We didn't have signs in the North or in the West, but we had segregation. And so we talk about the period of Jim Crow because there's a great deal about that that most Americans don't have a clue about. In fact, that's probably the least known part of American history is the period from the 1880s through the 1960s. We just don't know much about it. So we cover that and we talk about the race riots that occurred, whites attacking black communities in the early 1900s, just after World War I. 1919 is known as Red Summer. There were 25 major race riots where whites attacked black communities, looted homes, looted businesses, destroyed homes and businesses, killed black people. And so that's really a big part of the history that's hidden. Obviously, we talk about the civil rights movement, and we also look at the age of mass incarceration and that impact that it's had, looking at modern day injustices and things such as police brutality, and continued discrimination in housing, continued discrimination in the job market. All of those things are part of this ongoing black Holocaust.
Well, Reggie, thank you so much for joining us once again here on Lake Effect and talking about your work.
Thank you so much, Joy. It was great seeing you again, and thank you.
Reggie Jackson is the head griot of America's Black Holocaust Museum, and he's the subject of a feature in this month's Milwaukee Magazine.
You can hear more interviews like this one by visiting the Lake Effect page at WUWM.com.